Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
When you say you're a large Irish family, let's just get some perspective. You have 52 first cousins.
Yeah, that's quite a lot, isn't it? My sense of who I am is really rooted in the fact that I'm part of a wider extended family. And we had the reception at the same place they had the reception in Love Actually. And I had the same best man as they had in Love Actually. It's a bit weird. It wasn't a Love Actually themed wedding, but it sort of might as well
have.
Yeah. He is still holding my hand when we walk down the road. And I know we're on the cusp. Any minute now,
it's gone.
He's suddenly going to work out, what am I doing? You watch your mum go from incredibly healthy, active 45-year-old and watch her decline in 6 months and then die. It's a profound and very, very vivid demonstration of quite how fragile we are and how little time we're alive.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. And my guest this week is an actor, an author, and who knew, a qualified lawyer. Born in London to working-class Irish parents, his dad was a builder, his mum was a barmaid, he won a scholarship to private school, boarding school no less, and then on to study law at Cambridge. But after losing his mum when he was just 22 and she was just 45, he decided life was way too short for a career in law and rerouted from the bar to RADA to pursue his love of acting. From RADA came years of critically acclaimed stage shows before being cast as Adrian Mole in the BBC's Adrian Mole, The Cappuccino Years. And then the BAFTA award-winning Green Wing with Olivia Colman, episodes with Matt LeBlanc and The Split with Nicola Walker for the BBC. Away from his work as an actor, he's also a writer, a host on Have I Got News For You and on Sky Arts' Portrait Artist of the Year show. And alongside appearing on Celebrity Gogglebox with his sister Anita, he also happens to write children's books with her, the fifth of which has just been released. A father to three boys, he lives in London with his wife, the actress Louise Delamere, and together alongside her brother, they run a very successful production company. I am a long-standing admirer of all of his works, so I'm really looking forward to this one. Let's dial him in, shall we? It's Stephen Mangan. How are you?
Hello, that was nice. Blimey.
Busy man.
How weird. Yeah, how weird to have your life kind of rolled out like that. But that's pretty much it. You pretty got nail on the head.
Great. Well, thanks for listening. And
what a weird time I've had of it.
You sort of have. I mean, your path has been curvaceous to say the least. No straight lines for you.
No, I think that is a reflection of my kind of itchy brain in that I find it exciting to do stuff that I haven't done before, and I'm constantly looking for new things to do. And if someone suggests that I do something that I haven't tried before and it sounds like fun, I'll do it. I mean, and it's led me into all sorts of weird places, but I think it's confusing. Well, it's confusing me. Like, it's that scene, you know, that scene in Zoolander when he's looking at the puddle and he's going, who am I? Who am I? That's what I feel like I do a lot of the time. Who am I? What am I doing?
Do you know what, though? Your curiosity and appetite for all things is so apparent when you start to dig into you. And there was one article that I read that you'd written for The Telegraph, which was about your approach to adapting Lisa Kudrow's hugely successful web... her original was called Web Therapy. Yeah, and you called it Hang-Ups.
Yeah.
And how you adapted that from an American show to your own. And the way you wrote about it and the way you approached it, I just thought, you are just too smart to be just a turn. There is just, you must be quite frustrating in so many respects because you think like a writer, a producer, a director. You even come at it with the like, well, how are we going to finance this? And I mean, literally, there's probably not a job on a production I can't imagine you couldn't do.
Well, that's very kind. I mean, I don't know about that, but I do know that it's weird. I think we all do this in different ways. I mean, you know, you switch on and off different bits of your brain, don't you? And it's sometimes a relief to be, say, you know, to be acting, say, to be, I don't know, doing a scene in The Split with Nicola where we're both desperately upset about the end of our marriage, and to allow yourself just to go into that sort of emotional space. And then as a relief from that occasionally to pop out and go, okay, well, how do you write a TV show? How do you, you know, how are scenes constructed? How do you construct a series? How do you put, you know, what's the best way to begin a show and end it and keep an audience's attention? And then occasionally, but only occasionally, because it's not, it's interesting, but it's not that interesting to work out how to fund these things and do the mathsy bit.
Because, that's so, you know, painful.
It's interesting to know how it's put together, but I wouldn't want to do it all the time. So, yeah, I think increasingly acting is very much a sort of team thing. You know, you're working with a whole group of people to try and bring a script to life, whether it's a play or a film or a TV show. So you're sort of collaborating and you're trying to put this thing together and you're chipping in ideas and other people are chipping in ideas, and it's a real team effort. And then it's occasionally nice to go away and sit in a room and just do something completely on your own and write a children's book that, you know, you are completely the master of that entire world. So, you know, I swing between those two things because they both have great appeal for me. But after you've done one of them for a while, you think, do you know what? It'd be quite nice to leave my little study and go out and see human beings again.
You need different tastes and textures, don't you? Just to keep you stimulated. But so do you not find though that the kind of as life becomes longer and longer and your experience is more and more
I'm old, is that
varied?
What you're
no, what I mean is that you end up kind of like for example, you qualified as a lawyer, you end up playing a barrister. I mean, like everything comes 360. You just talked about that, you know, the trials and tribulations of trying to get a production together, and yet you end up doing however many seasons, what was it, 6-7 seasons of episodes where you play that guy doing exactly that, you know?
Yeah. Well, it all sort of feeds into it, doesn't it? I mean, playing a barrister on The Split, that was the life I could have had and was heading towards. I mean, it was like, here's what you could have won. And I tell you what, it's much more fun to dress up and pretend to be a barrister, I think, than to do it for 40 or 50 years. But yeah, I mean, I think in all walks of life, and especially in creative jobs, the more experience you can have of all sorts of different things, of different people, of different situations, the better. It all feeds into your work at some point, hopefully.
Yeah. I think so, but I still think there's a problem with it in our industry where people sort of cross their arms in meetings and go, but they're more than one thing. Therefore, blimey, what are we going to do with them?
I know.
Whereas in America, you've got so many, you know, multi-hyphenates, you are literally king of the hill.
I think that's changing, though. I think, I mean, when I started out as an actor, if you wanted to do, say, musical theatre, that was its own entire world. And you were either in that world or you weren't. It wasn't something you sort of dipped in and out of. People were musical theatre people or they were straight actors. But now you get people like Alan Cumming doing The Traitors in America and, you know, you
get Waddingham.
Hannah Waddingham, I mean, James Corden obviously does all these different things. Stephen Fry is an actor and, you know, Hugh Laurie writes and you know, Emma Thompson has won Oscars for acting and writing. So I think the sort of stay in your lane attitude is changing. But I know what you mean. There's a certain suspicion. And I'm guilty of it as anybody. I mean, you sometimes hear pop stars or, you know, sports, you know, men or women saying, oh, I quite fancy a bit of acting. And you, as a, you know, as the actor in you wants to
just,
well, it's not
just
that,
punch them.
I went to RADA for 3 years to learn how to do it. I slogged my guts out in the theatre, you know. But, of course, some of them do it and they're brilliant, effortlessly brilliant straight away. I think that world is changing and you are allowed, I think, to do more than one thing now. I hope so.
Well, you're screwed otherwise, yeah. I mean, exactly. Literally, you've got to pick a lane. I wouldn't want to pick a lane. Why should we? Oh. Although, I suppose there is the inevitable eye roll when somebody who is well known for other things comes into a notoriously difficult sector like children's publishing, right? And you go, yeah, I'm going to write, a children's book. I mean, I'm going to caveat for the listener. Don't you worry, kids. He's all over this. This is the third of three very excellent children's books.
It's my fifth, actually.
It's my
fifth book, yeah. The Day I Fell Into the Toilet, as it's called, is number five.
Oh, hold on. Well, so what have I missed? So I have got Escape the Room. Escape the Room. Then The Fart That Changed the World.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then what came after that?
Then we had the unlikely rise of Harry Sponge. And then just before Christmas, the Great Reindeer Rescue.
Blimey. Season.
But you, it's like, of course, that there's such a vast range. It's like music, for example. There is a big difference between, say, a manufactured pop star who can't actually sing in real life, who's auto-tuned, and it's basically, you know, are sort of hidden behind all the production. They don't really do anything. All the way up to, I don't know, a classical composer or someone who writes and plays 50, or Prince, you know, who can play a dozen different instruments and write and sing and do everything. You know, they're all pop star, they're all, you know, musicians, but the range is huge. But I take your point about, you know, children's books, and I didn't do any writing of any kind for years because I felt like I'd worked so hard to be an actor. I'd spent, you know, literally a couple of decades going to drama school and doing play after play after play and then getting into TV and films and really learning how to do it. And I thought, out of sort of respect for writers, it's not something you think, well, I can just pick it up and do it. As I got older, I started to write some TV, you know, starting with the odds. You know, I wrote the odd scene on Green Wing. Victoria Parr was really encouraging me to write. And then I wrote Hang Ups, or co-wrote it with Robert, my brother-in-law. And I started to do more and more writing. And when my sister suggested doing a children's book, it wasn't that I felt I'd sort of earned the right, but I think the proof is in the pudding. You know, if the books are good and they stand up on their own, I think it's fair enough. I think if you use your, quote, celebrity to sell a few books and the books are a waste of everybody's time, I think that's a little bit more tawdry and shouldn't be encouraged. But,
or you have to at least write the damn things, right? Rather than hiring somebody else to do it for you.
And I tell you what, I mean, you know, they are, anyone who's finished a book should be carried shoulder high through the streets. Gosh, don't they?
It's a lot.
They take so much effort. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's, for someone who, you know, if you're in a TV show, you know, you might spend 3 months filming it, but you go along every day and you film. You work long hours, but, you know, you are part of a machine. But to sit down at a desk for week after week after week after week and write a book, it's really, you know, it takes a lot of self-discipline. And I'm sort of probably as proud of the children's books I've written as anything else I've done in my career.
Oh, you really should be. I mean, they're vivid, they're fabulous. You really go there. And then the fact that you've brought your sister in on this as well, it makes it a proper family affair. And this isn't just a handful of illustrations by your sister. These are pages and pages and pages. I mean, you've really made, you know, you've blunted the lead in her pencil, for sure.
Well, it was her idea to start with, to do something together. And I thought originally, children's books, maybe we should do a picture book where there's one sentence on every page. And, you know, maybe I could sort of do it in a week. But she was insistent that I write a proper novel. So I did. And so it's her fault if she has to do a lot of, I mean, I do sit there as I'm writing and try and think of the most ridiculous things that she has to draw, because I'm her older brother, you know, and that's the law. You've got to be annoying to your younger sister. So yeah, I do. It's a treat. It's a treat to work together.
And this is properly her day job. We should just point out she's not just good at drawing. This is your sister whose clients include people like Ella's Kitchen, for example, or the Leon cookbooks, which are fantastic. By the way, I have one.
They are great. I mean, all those Leon cookbooks, they have lots of pictures of families at the beginning and the end, if you look at them. And a lot of those are of us when we were 4 or 5 years old. But she's a properly good graphic designer and illustrator. I think she's been involved in 70 or 80 books now. Wow. So,
and she does Gogglebox with you, obviously. So some people will be familiar with her and how much you two look alike, by the way.
Yeah, it's insane, isn't it? If ever I have to do anything where I have to put a wig on, it's just, I might as well send her to work instead of me. We look absolutely identical. And we're exactly a year apart, pretty much. So, it's really freaky.
See, most people run a mile from the prospect of working with their family, but you've positively embraced it. You also work with your wife and your brother-in-law, and the hang-ups that we talked about earlier, that was entirely a family affair from you guys, wasn't it? And not only were you making a show, but you were making an adaptation of an already big hit show. I mean, talk about pile on the pressure.
Yeah, but it's like, I don't know, but I think it's from our childhood. My dad and his brothers all worked together, and my dad and his sisters as well. They, you know,
really?
There was 9 of them, and I think about seven of them worked together at one point. And my mum had 5 brothers, and they worked together. So it was never really something that felt odd or a stretch. It makes it tricky when you come home if you've been working all day, you know, with your wife, and I'm sure Louise feels the same way. It's hard to escape it, because if something's on your mind, you know, it's hard not to bring it up in the evenings or in the mornings, and it's sometimes nice to have a bit of separation. But, you know, they're the people I know best and I love most, so it's a treat to work with them.
Well, as you've highlighted, your family has form when it comes to working together, which is where I'd like to go for my first question with you, if that's all right. I wanted to touch on the fact that you are, in fact, when you say you're a large Irish family, let's just get some perspective. You have 52 first cousins.
Yeah, that's quite a lot, isn't it?
I mean, like, we're almost at 2 classrooms there.
Yeah, I mean, my kids have 6 first cousins, so that, which is probably more normal, isn't it? Yeah, they were just a big family, and my mum had a brother who put more work in than most. I mean, he was divorced with 2 kids by the time he was 19, which is you know, really going for it. And then he kind of had several more. Yeah, they were just a big family, and that was it. And we used to see them all every summer. I mean, my mum and my dad are from villages about 2 miles apart. On the west coast of Ireland, and they sort of really met properly over here in London, because, as I'm sure most people are aware, you know, when you emigrate, you go to where the rest of your gang are, the rest of your people are, and especially true of the Irish community, you tend to go to a pub that was run by somebody from your village or whatever. So there was a pub in Camden called the Camden Stores, which is no longer there, but it's on Parkway. And my mum was a barmaid there, and that was the place all the people from that area would hang out and then go dancing in Camden. And that's where they sort of, mum and dad, met and got married pretty young. But yeah, my mum's brothers were all builders. They lived on the south coast in Chichester, and my dad's and his brothers were all builders, and they had a, you know, place in Finsbury Park, and they lived in Kilburn and Wilson. I mean, it's a really well-trodden story, really. The irony being, of course, I ended up going to a posh public school, and everyone thinks I'm sort of very posh, but not really. I'm pulling the wool over people's eyes there. I'm not really like that.
Well, you're a bit of both.
I suppose I am a bit of both, yeah, definitely.
But obviously the scale of the Irish family is something that you really fell into and loved and found great comfort in. So when you lost both of your parents and you were still incredibly young when that was the case, you convinced your two sisters to buy a house with your pooled inheritance. And you've created something that allows you to carry that on. And I thought that was so beautiful. And reading about how you and your sister talk about this creation, this home, this kind of church almost that you've created for you and your parents. And because we all forget what it is, you know, like I know that I can go home to my mum and dad's place and the family pictures will be on the wall. There's probably a load of my old rubbish from my youth in the loft. You lost all of that and decided, no, we're not going to lose it. We're going to recreate it. Tell me about that place and what it's meant to you over these years.
Yeah, you lose when they both go, you lose that, you know, common meeting place, that shared home. And like you say, even some of the furniture and the pictures, and it just seemed a shame not to try and do something about that. And you know, because we're lucky enough to have a decent relationship and we get on with each other and trust each other, we just figured we'd buy a small place in the country that would, you know, that we could cram us all into if we needed to, and it's where we can all hang out. Because there's a big difference, isn't there, between meeting for lunch or dinner, or spending a few days where you're there in the evening and you go to bed and you wake up and they're still there the next morning. That's there's something really special about that. And when it's removed from your daily life and you're not rushing off at the end of a meal or, you know, a visit to the pub or a children's party or whatever. So, yeah, we've always been close and we've always wanted to keep that contact going. So yeah, I'm really pleased we did it.
But I guess it's not just what you three get from it, it's also about what your collective children get from it, because you're continuing that sense of family. And I think you're so right, you know, to wake up or have a sleepover when your kids, or share breakfast together, to brush your teeth together, just that's the regular everyday family stuff that you wouldn't otherwise be able to give them or gift them.
Exactly. I mean, my sense of who I am is really rooted in the fact that I'm part of a wider extended family. Mm. They're not just some people that I know because we're related. And, you know, that's who I am. I'm part of that gang. And I love it. And I, you know, I still take my boys back to Ireland every summer. There's a week where we... all the Mangan side of the family will get together, and they'll come from all over the British Isles and further afield. And there's just dozens of people who look like me all hanging out with each other. What more could you want?
It's like, it's like a Comic-Con for Stephen Mangan fans.
Sort of teeth and eyebrows.
And how... I mean, how well do you all know each other, the 52 of you and your relatives?
it depends which bit of the family you're talking about. The Mangan side are much more in touch, but my mum's family, although we know each other and we just don't see as much of each other, they just don't live as close by, and they're a bit more scattered. But yeah, I mean, it's just the way I am. And I do look at people who are, say, only childs, and just, or, you know, those people who have, or a son of an only child or daughter of an only child, and have no cousins and no aunts or uncles. And I'm like, it's just, they look like exotic creatures to me. I just don't understand how you can not have hundreds of people with big eyebrows and teeth that all look a lot like you. I mean, what?
You could fill a coach with your lot.
We could fill several coaches. I mean, our wedding was enormous, but that was because we wanted them all there. So, yeah.
Where did you have your wedding then, in order to accommodate all of these?
We had it in London. We had it in London, but we put everyone on a boat after the service and went down the Thames to Battersea. And then there was a kind of big... a big, it was weirdly, and I didn't think about this at the time, but Andrew Lincoln, who was I was at drama school with, was my best man. I had two best men, Paul Thorney and Andrew. And we had the reception at the same place they have the reception in Love Actually. And I had the same best man as they had in Love Actually. It was a bit weird. It wasn't a Love Actually themed wedding, but it sort of might as well have been. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Yeah. Weird.
When you first started dating your wife and she realised that, you know, you came like in a multi-pack by way of relatives, yeah. was she scared?
No, because she's the same.
Oh,
she's
right.
Exactly the same. She has three brothers, and you get one of them, you get one Delamere, you get them all. And then they have cousins that they, but, you know, she is definitely part of a unit. She understands that family thing completely. And I think that's one of the reasons we hit it off so quickly and so profoundly, was because we just got each other. I mean, she's from the Wirral, from a sort of, I mean, they don't say they're Irish, but they might as well. I mean,
they might as well be, yeah.
They might as well.
Can we
be.
Say that without being cancelled? I don't know.
Well, I don't, you know, they are, they're, you know, her grandmother was called Peggy O'Brien. So, you
okay,
know, there's a bit of Irish, there's a bit of Irish blood in there. And, yeah, we just got that family thing immediately. And so it wasn't something I had to explain or, you know, it could be quite intimidating meeting one or two relatives, let alone three coach loads full, but she handled it beautifully.
Your parties must be epic, Stephen.
Yeah. Well, it's also hard to, because of course everyone, all my cousins have now had kids, or a lot of them have had kids. So the numbers are getting really unmanageable. I may have to have my next big birthday at the O2 Centre.
I think you could sell it.
Do you know what I mean? I think that's probably a venue like that is what we need. Wembley Arena.
But you know what? I mean, it comes in handy when, for example, you're launching a book. I mean, all you have to do is hit up the family WhatsApp and you've already charted. Please all go and buy a copy.
Exactly. Very ready-made audience.
Absolutely.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Are you ready for your second question?
Sure.
In many ways, writing children's books has proved to be a great therapy for you and your sister, especially with the first book you wrote, Escape the Room, which for me, I mean, this is my take out, was a bit of a timely tale as to how, as children, you cannot expect to short circuit or fast forward your way through grief. So I wondered, where else in life have you found therapy away from a psychiatrist's couch?
I think, well, that's interesting. I think my job, I mean, you know, the job of an actor is to look into what it's like to be a human being, and most comedies and dramas are written about those extreme moments in life. You know, dramas don't tend to be about happy people being happy. They tend to be about people who are, you know, going through marital problems, relationship problems, or things are getting a bit murdery and they're a bit terrified, or
a bit murdery,
you know, there's a lot of murdery stuff going on. So, you know, you are if you're doing a play, I did Private Lives last summer in the West End, and that, you know, that's a play about relationships and how hard they can be and how passion can be a flip side to, you know, sort of terrible rows and arguments, and you know, you're sort of, my working life is spent thinking about those things and putting myself in those situations and trying to imagine what it's like to someone to tell you they've cheated on you, or that they're leaving you, or that, you know, that they're going to murder you. And that's the reason I didn't become a lawyer. When you study law, it's all about stripping the emotion out of scenes, out of situations. You know, if you're doing criminal law, yeah, it's about taking the emotion out of that moment and going, what were they actually thinking of doing, and how were they doing it, and what were their intentions, and to try and dispassionately look at these very, very extraordinary moments in life. And I remember thinking, but the emotion is the interesting bit.
Yeah, you're so right. They just deal in, they trade in facts, and you just have opted to spend your life living in a permanent state of extreme emotion.
Yeah. We had one scene, you know, there's one law case where there was somebody, a man standing on a bedroom window, and a bit of his foot or something was in the room, and does that count? Has he actually entered the building? Is that breaking and entering? And is that, you know, burglary, or is it this or something else? And there was a woman in the bed, and I thought, it's far more interesting, like, what's that woman thinking who's lying in the bed and sees someone at the thing? Or what's the guy in the window? How's he feeling? That, to me, is interesting, not whether technically it's one thing or another.
That's really fascinating, actually, because you were the proverbial square peg in a round hole studying law at Cambridge then. It was the extreme end of where you didn't want to be.
Yeah, and I really realised that once I got there, and I suddenly thought,
shit.
Oh, whoops. I didn't really know anything about law. I mean, we didn't have the internet, and I didn't really look too much into it. I just remember watching, you know, courtroom dramas on telly where people are standing up and looking all butch and saying really exciting things, and everyone going, you're a hero, you've saved that person from being thrown to prison or whatever it was. I thought, you know, I didn't really think too hard about it. But that's why you study, I suppose. That's why you do anything, to find out whether it's actually your thing or not. Yeah, I mean, I went from a law degree to going to RADA. You can't get a bigger shift than that, really. A sort of total throw the car into reverse, because you're 3 years spent trying to analyze stuff and think very precisely and logically with reason and rigor, and then suddenly you're lying on the floor pretending to be a piece of bacon in a frying pan. It wasn't too much of that, but you know what I mean.
Have it so of that, yeah. Be a tree, that kind of stuff, yeah.
Be a tree, sure, yeah.
But we recently had on, I don't know if you're familiar with his work, Lee Francis, who...
Oh, I listened to that episode. I love Lee. He's brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah. He's lovely. But he talked about how he got the guts to leave a job that he trained for, a bit like yourself, to give it all up, just move to London and try his luck as a comic, because he'd just lost a parent. And that was pretty much your experience as well, wasn't it?
Exactly my experience. I left university in May or June. My mum got ill in early September. I'd got this law degree, but I wasn't intending to be a lawyer. I didn't really know what I wanted. I wanted to be an actor, but that didn't seem... on the, like, you know, might as well wanted to have been the Pope or an astronaut or something. It was just so far out of my family experience and the people I knew. And Mum died 6 months later, aged 45. Her mum had died at 47. So you look at that pattern and you think, it's not looking good. I mean, I could literally have 25 years left. And when you're 20 or 21, It's very hard to conceive of yourself getting old and of time passing. We're not wired like that as human beings, are we? It's hard to get a handle on it. But when you watch your mum go from incredibly healthy, active 45-year-old and watch her decline in 6 months and then die, it's a profound and very, very vivid demonstration of quite how fragile we are and how little time we're alive. So I think I had my audition for RADA maybe a week after she died. I applied a few weeks before she died. I just thought, I want to do what I want to do. I want to give it a go because I think I'll always regret it if I don't. Mm. And the audition happened to come through a week after her funeral. And I thought, sod it, I'll just do it. And actually, you know, anyone who's been for a job interview of any sort, let alone an audition, I think sometimes if you don't give a shit, it's quite helpful, actually. You know, that sort of people who are desperate, please give me the job. It's not attractive in some way, is it? So I couldn't have cared, frankly, less. And I think that helped. And yeah, then I went off and I did 3 years at RADA. And I think part of the reason that was good for me and useful for me was not only was I doing what I wanted to do, but I could hide from the world for 3 years because I was really grieving and my whole life was thrown into chaos. I didn't really know which way was up. And to just plod into central London and go and work on scenes or do voice exercises or learn to sing or any of those things you do at drama school, it was a little cocoon that I could hide in while I tried to process what had happened to my mum.
And that's exactly what Lee did. He just fled the scene, came somewhere else to be someone else, someone that he hadn't trained to be, and that felt safe, even though it was probably the scariest thing that he could have done or you could have done at that time. So we should, just to give people a little bit of background, you know, your education at Cambridge, you were the great hope of the family. I mean, like, there was, I'm quoting your sister here, but there was you were always treated like the superior sibling because of your gender, not just by your mum and dad, but by your grandparents as well. So it was... All hopes rode with you, because, you know, I suppose historically they always looked to the man of the family to be the carer, the provider. So everything had gone on they put the money on you, and you went, I'm not doing that.
Yeah. Well, I felt I'd done it by getting into Cambridge and getting a degree. I felt like...
Because your sisters went to state school, didn't they?
Yeah, I got a scholarship into a private boarding school. My sisters went to the local state school. A sexist kind of attitude. There's no question about it. The men, I don't think it was just a kind of...
No malice to it. It's just a reflection of the times, right?
A reflection of the time, you know. My mum gave up work when she had me, you know, and that was what was kind of expected, or a lot of people did and still do, you know, and it's... I think my parents were both really bright, but the education they had was unbelievably, shockingly bad.
They both left school at 14, weren't they?
They both left school at 14. They were educating the west coast of Ireland. There just wasn't the quality of teaching, you know. They both sort of were autodidacts and taught themselves. They're both very curious people. Mum would sort of love literature and would read voraciously. They kind of missed out on a decent education. Mm. And I had that opportunity. So I think they were quite excited for me and were living slightly vicariously through me as well. They'd love to have had that opportunity, but didn't. So, yeah, I was the first one to go to university, and then I read a subject and then packed it in immediately. But, you know.
Great pride.
Yeah. But I think we should be allowed to wonder whether it's whether it's just intellectually, mentally, emotionally, we should be allowed to have some time to work out what we want to do. And that's, I don't mean, you know, I think you're not going to make people who aren't, who aren't industrious. Some people just are more laid back and aren't that bothered. And some people will work hard. But, you know, for a while, take the pressure off. It breaks my heart when you see children starting to plan their careers when they're in a sort of 11, 12 years old, you know, and starting magazines because they want to be a writer. And I don't know, which is fine for some of them, but don't, I don't know, let people, some of the most interesting people I know are the people who had no idea what they wanted to do, and they did a bit of this, and they went off and did something else, and they did something else. And even now, they're still not necessarily following a path, a traditional path, but they're just, they're going where their curiosity and their heart is taking them. And that, you know, that's fantastic. I wish we had a bit more space, but obviously, you know, financial pressures and all sorts of other things make that very, very difficult for people to do. And that's such a shame. I think it's something as a society, we sort of get really wrong. People have to put their head down and work their asses off just to keep their head above water. And it's a shame.
It is. And also, you know, I think we work for longer than ever before in a world that is changing faster than it ever has before. I mean, the digital revolution makes the industrial revolution look slack in terms of the advances that we make. So you have to encourage people to be adaptable, to be portfolio in their approach to themselves, to allow themselves to have multiple identities across the years and encourage that. Otherwise, you just... you've just beaten it out of them, and actually you should be their biggest hype man on that front. I think that's certainly what I tell my son as he goes out into the world. It's like, you're probably going to end up doing a job that doesn't even exist right now, and just, you know, all you can do to prepare for that is just be a really nice person and a hardworking one. And yeah, I mean,
that's it. The only advice I've ever given anyone, I was asked to do the graduation thing at RADA one year, and they say, will you give them some advice about acting and how to be an actor? And I was like, no, because advice is really tricky, because I thought about it long and hard, and I basically, all I came up with was three things: work hard, be on time, don't be a dick. That was basically it. And I think that's what I tell my kids, you know, be a nice person, put the effort in it, because, you know, it, just to be selfish, because, you know, it's true. The more you put in, the more you get out, you know, and don't be late, because being late is annoying
and rude
and aggressive.
Especially when you're like, you know, in the professions that we are, you know, if we rock up late to a set, you're holding everyone up. That's highly insulting.
Yeah, no, I learned that lesson really early on. I think my very first show was at the Redgrave Theatre in Farnham. It was just a few weeks after I'd left drama school. And I was in a play there, and I was driving down to the theatre for the Saturday matinee, but there was a rugby match on at Twickenham, and I was caught up in all this. And this is before I had mobile phones. I didn't have a mobile phone to ring ahead. And I sort of screeched up to the theatre 2 minutes before the play started. And the way into the dressing rooms was through the foyer. And there was 400 people in the foyer, standing there waiting, because they weren't allowed in because they thought the show would have to be cancelled because I hadn't turned up. And the guy on the PA just went, "We're sorry for the continuous delay." Oh, there he is.
Oh, no.
He saw me through the office window. He went, "There he is." And everyone, all 400 people turned around and looked at me with disgust.
Never again.
Never again.
Timing is everything, isn't it?
It is everything.
And being on time really is everything.
Well, you know, I think so.
I wondered if you could elect a moment in time in which you would happily be lost in forever. If you had to get stuck in a moment, what would it be, and why that moment?
Well, that's a really tricky question. I think the first thing that springs to mind, because I sort of had this thought yesterday. We were walking, me and Frank and Jack, who are my two youngest boys, were walking to meet Louise and Harry for lunch through Regent's Park. And Jack is 7, he turns 8 soon, and he is still holding my hand when we walk down the road. That little hot hand that is just there. You don't even have to reach for it. It's just there.
It's given. It's a given.
And he wants to, and it's and I know we're on the cusp. Any minute now,
it's gone.
He's suddenly going to work out, what am I doing? What am I doing holding my dad's hand walking down the road? And at the moment, he hasn't. And as we were doing that yesterday, I just thought, my God, I know it's coming because I've got two older kids, and I know that moment's coming. And, you know, of course it's coming because... But I would love to freeze or be able to, you know, that moment never to come. I don't want to step over that particular threshold, because it's a small thing, but it's a huge thing. It's kind of your children go from being entirely your responsibility. You are their entire world. And then slowly they start going to nursery and school, and as they should, their world expands and expands. And, you know, my 16-year-old now, it's like having a flatmate. I mean, rather than a kid, because he's texting me, I'm going out, and you hear the door slam, and then he's back in. You're like, all right, Harry. He's like, yeah. And then, why is there any milk? You know, so that's, and he suddenly got this, you know, I mean, he's bigger than me. He's 2 inches taller than me. He's more mature than I've ever been in my life. So, you know, that will happen, and it's got to happen. But, oh, I don't know, there's something that I want to cling on to about that just simple little thing of holding that little hand.
That's beautiful. I really get it, Stephen. I ache for those moments. As you're saying it, I can feel my heart aching.
Yeah.
And I can remember my son. My son's 15, so I'm kind of in the same ballpark as you with Harry. And I'm so honoured now if he lets me touch him and he doesn't flinch. I mean, that in itself is an honour. And it will come back. I know it will. And it's absolutely right that they should be independent of us. And that's a congratulations to us as parents that they feel that they can do that.
Yeah.
But my goodness, you know, those nights when I can't sleep, I lie in bed and I roller desk all those moments where he was tiny. And, you know, we had Jess Phillips, the MP, on, and she said something really profound that really has stuck with me all these years on. She said, I think it was her husband that said to her, you know, you don't know the day, but it comes to us all, when you don't pick your child up again. You never put them back on yet, that your hip. And like, if you knew that that was the last time, my God, you'd never let go.
You would never let go.
Would you?
And it has echoes as well. When I'm going around to my dad's flat, you know, and when I was in my 30s, and he would open the door and, you know, he'd give me a kiss on the cheek. And I, you know, he must have thought the same way about me. I think about my boys, which is that you're seeing all those versions of them at once. You're seeing the person they are now, but you still can't let go of that little baby you held in your arms, or that little toddler. Yes, they're all there in that one person, and they're all, yeah.
But don't you think, though, as a creative, as a writer, as a producer, as an actor, we devote so much of our culture to celebrating love affairs, and yet so little of that is poured into arguably the greatest love affairs in our lives, which are those between a parent and a child. I mean,
I think that's really true. Partly because, I suppose, yeah. Now, this is where my brain works. I'm now thinking, why is that? What is that about? And I, you know, the thing that occurs to me is, it's quite a neat story when you meet someone and fall in love and then you get together. That's got a sort of beginning, middle and an end of its own. But you're right, the child thing, which hopefully, touch wood, is a relationship that will be decades and decades long, it's less screen friendly or story friendly, because you're right, it's
less told.
Less told.
And we only tell it if it's like a dysfunctional family relationship, or you're estranged from your parents. But
yeah, or something terrible has happened.
Yeah, the travesty, you know, there has to be a tragedy in the middle of it, or a travesty of some sort. But actually, it's the most beautiful and uncomplicated, for me certainly, has been my experience, love I've ever known. And then when I look at my parents' looking, you know, I used to joke for years that, you know, my dad would literally ring the doorbell. So my mum and dad lived like 3 hours from me. So he'd get out the car off this long drive and I'd open the front door and say, hiya. And he would literally push past me and go, where is he? Right? And I used to think, my God, yeah. It's like I don't even exist. And what I've come to understand is, of course, they love him. They love him so hard. But for them, they get a little bit of that back when I was that age, when my brother was that age. So for them, it's so layered and so beautiful.
Yeah.
And we don't tell that either.
No, we don't. We don't tell that story, the, you know, grandparents and how that ripples through a family. Mm. And, you know, we had our kids pretty late, Lou and I. I mean, like I said, I've got a 7-year-old and I'm in my 50s now. And I've sort of, part of me is kicking myself because I want to be around for all of that. I want to see their children, their children's children, their children's children's children. So I need to live till I'm about 160. So that's what I'm working on.
I think you need to become friends with Elon Musk. He might be your only hope on this front.
Oh, God, do I have to?
I can't think of anything else.
Okay. If that's depressing. What it takes, I'll do it. That's how much I love my children.
Thank you so much for your time today. I have really, when I said at the top of the show, I am a long-standing admirer of your work. I truly mean that in everything that you do. And I love the fact that you travel in so many lanes and so eloquently in all of them. So thank you.
Oh, that's so kind of you. Thank you. I loved it, Kate. Thanks very much.
Stephen and Anita's new book, their fifth, The Day I Fell Down the Toilet, is available now wherever you get your books. And if you're in the mood for more great conversations with fellow actors, we have episodes with Hannah Waddingham and Alan Cumming, who were mentioned in this episode in our back catalogue. Mark Bonner's in there, Sir Tony Robinson, Tracy Ann Oberman, Sally Lindsay, and, well, so many more. I'll be back on Tuesday with a little something for you from the White Wine Question Time seller. Oh, before I go, one more thing. Remember, you can always find us on Instagram for all the latest about the show. We're at @whitewine_questiontime. And also, please hit the follow button on Spotify. It's really, really helpful in terms of us being able to find you. Thanks so much for listening.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.